Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does marijuana use affect us as individuals and as a society? As a growing number of lawmakers and average citizens discuss relaxing prescriptions on pot, and some states have already taken steps to decriminalize its use, it is helpful to know what researchers are learning about the ways marijuana acts on bodies, brains, and communities. My guests today study marijuana's effects from different perspectives at the University of Texas at Dallas. Francesca Philby is Associate Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience. Robert Morris is Associate Professor of Criminology. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Has acceptance of marijuana research grown as more people have begun to advocate for decriminalization?
Well, I think there's been quite a bit of marijuana research for the last several decades. I think now is more of a time for embracing and kind of critiquing and being excited about that research because of new developments in legislation, for example.
So in other words, you can take – it's not so theoretical now. You can actually look at places where the laws are different and compare the effects.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. What about on your side, Francesca?
Well, my research is really focused on determining what it is that makes individuals susceptible to the effects of marijuana. And from my perspective really, things haven't changed all that dramatically because the same rate of problems in relation to marijuana use has stayed the same.
Is marijuana addictive in the same way that drugs like alcohol and cocaine are known to be addictive?
In terms of my research, which looks specifically at how the brain responds to them, it appears to be the case. There are individuals who are susceptible to these potent substances, and in a way, the brain responds to them in similar way, regardless of whether it's alcohol, cocaine, or marijuana. And basically, what we see is that it targets the reward pathway of the brain, releasing neurotransmitters, specifically dopamine. Therefore, those reward areas become even more engaged in the presence of those substances.
So is it more likely to be physiological factors that cause one person to become dependent on marijuana use rather than environmental factors or the way their lives are going, that sort of thing?
Well, there are certainly different factors that lead to the initiation of use, but the transition towards dependence is certainly one that's physiological. So you mentioned environmental risk factors. There are also genetic risk factors, for instance, that make one more likely to expose themselves to these chemicals. However, with continued use, the brain does adapt to the presence of these toxic substances and therefore start to adapt to just being exposed to them. And so these are the physiological changes that we've noticed. Some could be long-term and some could be short-term, but those are definitely the mechanisms that contribute to the maintenance of the addiction and also contribute to difficulties in abstaining.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is people can build up a tolerance if they use enough marijuana?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So tolerance is certainly one of those physiological changes where individuals need greater amounts of the substance in order to feel the exact same level of satisfaction that they once used to. Another one is craving. So just the intense desire to use the substance when they are not doing so.
We'll talk more about that in a minute. I do have a question that I actually will address to both of you, and I will start with you, Robert. What do we know about the sort of old idea that marijuana is a gateway drug to things that we, at least society, considers to be stronger, harder, more dangerous drugs?
Sure. That's a great question, and many people ask that in terms of, what's the reality behind does marijuana actually lead people to engage in other drugs and so forth? And the research findings over the decades have been pretty mixed. There's not conclusive evidence one way or the other. Most studies tend, for the marijuana's case, most studies tend to suggest that marijuana use itself and alone is not necessarily a causal factor of leading to other types of drugs. It's maybe more the environment or the social network and kind of a conglomerate of a lot of different factors that might start someone with marijuana and then they do lead to something else, but not necessarily the marijuana alone.
Is it possible? I've also heard the argument that marijuana is like a gate drug, that it, if you're satisfied by getting high on marijuana, maybe you're not so tempted to try other things.
I couldn't answer that question. My study is more about the effect from policy on, mm-hmm. on more aggregate level crime rates.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about from your perspective, Francesca, are people who use marijuana likely to use other intoxicants more than the general population?
Actually, we have found that marijuana users are about 60 or 70% of them are polysubstance abusers. It is difficult to find individuals, especially the kind of population that we're interested in, which are those who are really heavy users. It's very difficult to find individuals who use solely marijuana. Typically, people who use heavily also use tobacco. That seems to be the most prevalent combination. But oftentimes they do also use other substances. Now, whether it's a gateway drug, I'm not sure, because we are restricting our populations to heavy marijuana users. What I can say, though, about that is that marijuana is one of the first substances initiated by adolescence. The rate of initiation is as high as alcohol.
I don't want this to sound flip, and I fear that it might, but is it hard to get heavy marijuana users into the lab on a regular basis to participate in these studies?
You know, it's a great question, because we also wonder the same when starting this study, and the truth is it's not. There are a lot of users out there who want to be informed, who want to see this research done. I think that in general, people agree that there hasn't really been much done in terms of marijuana, what it really does to the brain, and that's really the motivation behind our research, is really to answer those important questions.
All right, let's move back to crime for a minute. Obviously, Robert, in the state of Texas and in many other states in the United States, simply possessing or using marijuana, people are breaking the law. Setting those laws aside for a moment, what do we know about the relationship between people who use marijuana and their likelihood to commit any other kind of crime?
Oh, that's also a really great question. And again, over the years, there have been mixed findings as to whether marijuana use is linked to criminal behavior. Though most studies tend to find that there's not an explicit relationship between marijuana use alone and engaging in other types of more illicit behaviors like crime. But that's definitely something that needs to be evaluated in more sophisticated ways. But overall, that's not something necessarily that comes to mind from the research.
There is the idea that perhaps because people who are using marijuana are willing to break that law, to sort of seek out somebody who's dealing marijuana, that perhaps their tolerance is a little bit higher for other kinds of property crime. What do we know about that?
Well, we really don't know that much about that specific element. What our study actually suggests is that we found no changes on crime rates from the legalization of marijuana for medical purposes. One of the arguments that we think might be a reason behind us finding no impact on crime was because perhaps the legalization brings individuals out of the criminal marketplace. And it is in the marketplace, perhaps, where the other crimes maybe transpire. In other words, in states where medical marijuana is legal, those that are going to be seeking that drug for their own treatment aren't going to have to go to a drug dealer, for example. If there is a dispute, they can actually go to the police without the ramifications associated with that illegality. So that's perhaps one major reason why there's less crime associated, or not more crime associated with legalization for medical purposes.
So clearly some people are seeking marijuana because it might relieve symptoms they have from a legitimate medical illness. There are other people who will tell you straight out they're using it for recreational purposes. Does, in states that have medical marijuana laws, does the recreational marijuana market end up getting funneled through the medical marijuana system?
You know, I don't know the numbers on that, but I think that it's obvious that where medical marijuana is legal, perhaps it's more abundant in the community. There have been some research studies published that suggest usage increases with the legalization for medical marijuana, and other studies that suggest no increases with the legalization for medical purposes.
Francesca, I know this is a little bit outside your area of expertise, but I think that you can probably address this question. When we talk about medical marijuana, there are a variety of conditions that it's prescribed for. What can you tell us in general about how it compares with other pharmaceuticals that are already out there in terms of their effectiveness for relieving things like nausea and the symptoms of glaucoma, that sort of thing?
I think what I can say is that the medicinal marijuana uses the crude in raw form of the cannabis plant, and so that's the main difference between medicinal marijuana and what's out there in the market that's FDA approved. So I think what FDA is trying to work towards is to try to create to harness the positive benefits of the cannabis plant, so selecting only those that have real positive benefits while reducing the harmful effects of the other constituents. So, you know, cannabis has over 400 compounds in it, and so it's quite a long process to try to harness just the benefits while minimizing the side effects or the negative potential negative effects of the other chemicals.
You spoke earlier about people who are heavy users or abusers. Where's the line between use and abuse with marijuana?
That is a good question as well, and one that we're continuously trying to navigate. My definition, at least as far as the my research and also what's out there in the literature, says is that by definition, about 4 times per week is what's considered heavy use. But really, the definition is one based on the actual effects, which is whether they start to show the behavioral symptoms of abuse or dependence. So whether they show this tolerance or the craving symptoms, as well as spending less time doing things that they used to enjoy. So once it actually does show interference with their daily lives, with their normal daily behavior, then that's when we consider it problematic.
Robert, how does legalization of marijuana for medical use affect the cost of the drug for people who want to get it?
You know, that's a great question. I don't have the answer to it. I would say that there's probably some impact, since without legalization, you're operating through a criminal marketplace, and that market is going to definitely operate differently than something that's legal.
Do we know anything about whether the presence of medical marijuana causes, say, teenagers to be more likely to try it because it's got this sort of halo of health?
That's a good question, too. And I don't know the specific answer to that. The studies that I've found in the literature, again, the findings tend to be mixed. It seems like there are more that suggest that people don't necessarily rush out to go and seek marijuana as soon as it becomes legal for medical purposes. But that's something that certainly should be addressed further in the future.
We're speaking this hour with two researchers from the University of Texas at Dallas. Robert Morris is Associate Professor of Criminology, and Francesca Philby is Associate Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience. We're talking about research into marijuana's effects on individuals and society. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with two researchers into the effects of marijuana on individuals and on society. Francesca Philby is Associate Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at UTD, and Robert Morris is Associate Professor there of Criminology. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. What can we learn, Robert, by looking at places like the Netherlands, where the use of marijuana has been tolerated? The laws are a little more complex than Americans think, but it's been tolerated for some time now.
Yeah, a lot of people bring up European countries and different perspectives on tolerance into the discussion of legalization for whatever reason in the United States. And the key distinction there is that in Europe, particularly in the Netherlands, that's a much more homogenous society. In the United States, we're very culturally diverse, or more economically diverse, or geographically diverse. So the comparisons there, you kind of have to tread with a lot of caution. The U.S. is very different from that perspective.
How diverse, Francesca, are the people that you bring into the lab for your studies?
They are very diverse. In our studies, we collect information on individuals from as young as 18 years old to 55 years old, and we definitely cover the entire age range. It might just be a factor of where we are, but we do attract a lot more female participants than male participants. That's not to say that's reflective of the general population, but we certainly cover a wide range of socioeconomic status as well as ethnic backgrounds.
There is, though, a sort of self-selecting issue here, right? Because you have to be willing to admit that you are a regular user of marijuana and then willing to take part in this study.
Exactly. So that's always a limitation in research, and one that we are aware of. So invariably, we always have to consider that when interpreting our findings.
Do you find that people are you testing blood levels or anything like that, or do you rely solely on what people are telling you about their use?
Great question. In addition to self-report, we also do collect urine samples that then goes through a process of quantifying THC in the system.
I wonder, Robert, if anyone has studied yet in states that have allowed marijuana for medical use, are there issues with, say, companies that drug test their employees? And has this come to be an issue of legal debate or conflict in these places?
I know there is a debate surrounding what happens when we legalize for whatever purposes, and how does that have an impact in the commercial marketplace. And I don't know of the specifics surrounding that debate. I have heard informally of and read articles that commercial organizations are responding in similar ways to how they react to alcohol use and alcohol misuse and so forth.
All right, let's talk about violent crime. We've talked a little bit about property crime. There was that movie in the 1930s, Reefer Madness, which I'm sure you're both aware of, that depicted marijuana users as these kind of depraved individuals running around committing murders. On the opposite end, there is the perception that some people have that, you know, if you smoke a joint, you can't possibly do anything besides sit on the couch. And I would imagine the truth is somewhere in between. What do we know about the rates of violent crime among people who are using marijuana?
Well, we know that most studies suggest that there's not a causal link between marijuana use and violent crime rates. In fact, in some of the models that we presented in our publication, and this is something that we're looking at further now, we found the findings suggested actually reductions in homicide and aggravated assault for states that had passed marijuana for medical purposes. Again, that this is the preliminary. This is something we need to look at further. But it kind of goes along with the research that's out there that doesn't find that link between violence and marijuana use.
Has enough time passed to know whether the states that have medical marijuana laws are saving money on criminal justice proceedings against people who are found with marijuana?
I think specific to time, I think there is. Our study looked at crime rates between 1990 and 2006. So we had a good time period there to evaluate. And we do know that, you know, less crime equates to less dollars on the ground. But that's how societies and jurisdictions respond to crime is very volatile.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of diversity. And so it would be difficult to gauge how much we're actually saving. But I think it's safe to assume that where there's less crime, there's less dollars being spent.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Bob in Fort Worth. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, I have had chronic pain for 15 years and have been through the gambit of all sorts of typical treatment, including a pain pump and a dorsal column stimulator, and none of these have really helped me too much. So I tried off-the-street marijuana because I'd heard of the medicinal effects, and I didn't really get that much help. My question is whether or not there are types of medical marijuana that differ enough that there are other kinds of marijuana that might help rather than just the street type of marijuana that I get.
Well, neither of our guests is a pharmacologist. I don't know whether this is something that either one of you, if you can't answer the question, maybe you could suggest where Bob could go to find that answer.
Bob, there are FDA-approved cannabis-related medications that you might be able to ask your doctor about, and they are FDA-approved for pain if you haven't yet. That's what I would recommend. And also the National Institute of Drug Abuse also has a good website that shows you the a list of all these types of medications.
Why does marijuana relieve pain for some people who use it? What are the effects on the brain?
This is not my area of expertise. Mm-hmm. Although what I can say is that the pathways that THC, the active ingredient in marijuana, targets a specific receptor in the brain. It's called the cannabinoid receptor of the brain. And that is one of the most ubiquitous receptors. And so not only is it in areas where you would expect to get the feelings of reward and pleasure that you do get from using marijuana, but it also goes into areas of the brain that modulate response to pain and also response to appetite. So it's by that mechanism that it does influence some of those behaviors.
Robert, one of the things that concerns people about drug laws in America is that they seem to affect people of different ethnic groups in different ways, right? The penalties are often thought to be harsher on people of color in the United States. Is there evidence or has anyone begun looking at whether decriminalizing marijuana, the places where this is starting to happen, whether that's leveling off?
You know, that's a really great question, and I know that there are plenty of really, really smart people that have dedicated their entire lives to studying that very thing in terms of an impact on race inequality and justice processes following legalization, whether for medical or for recreation. I don't know of the details. I know that it will certainly take more time to understand that fully as a result for legalization for recreational purposes, but I'm sorry I couldn't give you an answer on the other.
That's okay. I'm curious about whether researchers are really excited about Colorado simply because it's not a medical marijuana state. It's a state where recreational use is allowed, and so you have a more diverse population that you can study the effects of this on.
Absolutely. In terms of, from a scientific standpoint, it's interesting for lack of a better term, but it will definitely take time for those data to mature to where we can actually go in and analyze and assess the impact for legalization, recreationally speaking, for some time. It'll take a while, but that's definitely something that our eyes are open to, and we're looking forward to studying that very thing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Will in Dallas. Hi, Will.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Really love the show. I am a heavy user of the substance myself, And I wanted to point out that I live a very successful life, got a great job, great family, don't break any laws except for purchasing in my state where it's illegal. I do have a psychological disorder I'm treated for, and I feel that it really helps with that. But I wanted to know why or what research your guests have had that, you know, I could be, I know that I am addicted, but I don't find it as a problem in my life, and how that compares with other drugs where maybe the addictive effects are much stronger than the marijuana.
Thanks for your call. Francesca, any thoughts?
Yes. We certainly are acknowledge that that marijuana is not as potent in terms of its effects as other substances of abuse like cocaine. But we do know that 10% of those who use marijuana do become dependent on it, whereby they do start to show changes in behavior, and it starts to interfere with their lives. And so it's those individuals that we are really trying to characterize so that we might be able to help them better. Currently, there is really nothing that targets individuals who are seeking treatment for marijuana, and because nobody really knows what it does to the brain.
Are there physiological withdrawal effects for people who are heavy users that try to stop using pot?
Yeah. Interestingly, they actually do have almost the same types of withdrawal symptoms as other substances of abuse, obviously with varying degrees of severity, and certainly anecdotally less severe than that of other substances of abuse. But individuals who we have seen in our study have reported changes in appetite, also insomnia, and definitely some agitation.
What about driving, Robert? In states that have decriminalized marijuana for medical purposes, I have met people who say, I would never drink and drive, but it's not so dangerous to drive. I'm not putting this information forth myself, but there are people who believe that it's not dangerous to drive while using marijuana. Have states that have medical marijuana laws made sure to outlaw driving under the influence of marijuana?
I couldn't answer to specific states' legislation on that. I can say that there's an emerging body of literature looking at the impact from marijuana use on operating vehicles, and most of that does suggest that people can become and do become impaired while driving after using marijuana. That's something that is continuously being studied, and states should do all their due diligence in determining, you know, how their laws should be addressed to combat how the drug does influence people behind the wheel.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Joey in Denton. Hi, Joey.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
I was actually, a lot of what Will just now said kind of reflects what I was going to say, but I was more so wanting to know, how does one go about, whether it's volunteering or just kind of finding out the criteria of who can be a part of the study?
Thanks for your call.
Well, Joey, we actually are in active recruitment right now. You can go to our website at the Center for Brain Health at UT Dallas, and you'll be able to find your way to our website that describes the study and also provides a link to complete a survey to see if one is eligible. And actually, we currently have flyers all over the Metroplex, as well as an observer ad right now, with greater details on how to participate. But we are certainly actively recruiting.
Are there other things that you are looking for, other criteria besides the age requirements and how much people are using?
Yes, because we do look at how the brain functions, we want to make sure that individuals are going to be safe inside our MRI. So we just want to make sure that there aren't any contraindications like pregnancy or any non-removable metal in their body. We also require that English be their first language so that we can effectively communicate, and that the individuals be right-handed. Other than that,
I have to interrupt. Right-handed. Why is that?
Well, the brain, the way that the brain is organized is that it's very much lateralized. So different, one side is more dominant for one thing, and the other side is dominant for other things. And we can say that with some degree of certainty if you are right-handed, because that's sort of, it goes with how the brain is normally organized. If you're left-handed, we can't say, we don't have much to indicate how your brain might be organized. It could be the same as right-handed individuals, or it couldn't be. And so because we're interested in parts of the brain and how parts of the brain work and contribute to certain things, we don't want to create noise in what we're looking at.
What are some of the specific sensory inputs and experiences that you have found that trigger marijuana cravings?
Actually, we currently are looking specifically at tactile modality. So in the in our study, we provide we actually give the participants hand them the objects in addition to viewing the objects in their hand, so both visual and tactile input.
But talking about like pipes and bongs and that sort of thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Any type of paraphernalia. But we've also looked at other things, like not specific to marijuana, but we've also looked at just images or videos. Other researchers have found similar effects regardless of modality.
So it can be something somebody sees. It can be something somebody touches. Have you looked at the effect of the smell of marijuana?
I haven't looked at the smell exactly, but we've done a similar study in smell for tobacco and looking at the same thing, but not for marijuana. We've been trying to find a way to emulate the smell of marijuana. We can't get to anything that might be near accurate.
So. Oh, sure. You're saying you're not going to buy weed and
right.
burn it in the labs at UTD.
Exactly. Unfortunately,
we're speaking about the current research into the effects of marijuana on individuals and on society and criminal justice with Francesca Philby, who's associate professor of cognitive neuroscience at UTD, and Robert Morris, who is associate professor of criminology at UTD. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about research into the effects of marijuana with Robert Morris, who's associate professor of criminology at UTD, and Francesca Philby, who is associate professor of cognitive neuroscience. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phone now to Yasmin in Plano. Hi, Yasmin.
Hi.
Hi,
how are you today?
Great, thank you.
I'm calling. I actually attend the University of Texas in Dallas, and I was wondering what would happen if after many years in your teenage high school and college and you're maybe 21 years old, would your brain be able to recover to its original state after using marijuana, completely dropping it?
What do we know about long-term damage?
Great question, Yasmin, and it's actually one of the most important questions that we need to tackle. We still don't know what the long-term effects of marijuana are. We know that there are certainly changes. Whether they are irreversible is yet to be answered. And of course, there's a lot of individual variability. when you started, for instance, as you mentioned, if you started as an adolescent, the impact might be greater only because adolescence is a critical period for neurodevelopment. And so anything introduced to the brain at that particular time of neurodevelopment could certainly impact how the brain matures. And so in addition to just when you initiate marijuana use, it also makes a difference how much you use, but also your genetic predisposition. I mentioned earlier that genetic factors contribute to susceptibility to marijuana's effects. And so there may be individuals who are likely to recover better or quicker than others simply because of those factors.
So, Robert, we've talked about studies into whether or not marijuana users are more likely to commit crimes than members of the general population. What about neighborhoods where drug trafficking is an issue? Does legalization of marijuana tend to drive out some of the criminal element that may exist in sort of ancillary ways around heavy marijuana use?
I'm not sure as to whether it drives out a certain type of individuals from neighborhoods where sales might be more prevalent. I can say for sure that it certainly takes one item that they're selling off the table, how that impacts other markets and so forth. I don't know. I'm sure it does have an impact. For example, there are probably drug dealers out there that are exclusively selling marijuana, so they have a choice after it becomes legal. They can either go legitimate or find something else to do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Tony in Fort Worth. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I said Tony.
That's okay.
Yeah,
That's okay.
This is the first time calling the show. My grandpa's turned around on me and love it. My question is, I am 100% disabled combat vet, and I only smoke at night, where I can't smoke anything less than medicinal. I've been smoking pretty heavily for almost 3 years now, and I've smoked at my adolescence days, back to Yasmin's question. And, you know, when I went in the military, I quit, but I was still, you know, top of my class. You know, everything I did was top flight. And now since I can't smoke anything less than anything medicinal, but I only smoke at night, and the next morning it kind of carries over, you know, what is that? You know, what does that do? Since I don't have to smoke during the day, I only smoke at night.
I'm not sure if we totally understand your question, but maybe, Francesca, can you talk about how long the effects of marijuana linger and we can feel them if we smoke marijuana?
Yes. So, without considering one's tolerance, certainly marijuana, THC specifically, its effects last. Its effects last invariably depending on the potency of what you're using, but we see it rise up until about 3 days after you use, and then after 3 days you start to see the withdrawal effects. But certainly individual variability, as I mentioned before, contributes to your response to it. And as I mentioned, while the majority of individuals are, like yourself, are able to go on living healthy lives, there are a small percentage, about 10%, who have a negative response to marijuana.
Do those 10%, is there a gene that they have in common in the same way that there have been genes identified that predispose people to alcoholism?
Yes. In fact, that's one of the focus of our studies, is to determine the genetic mechanisms. And we have found, because THC targets the cannabinoid receptors, genes that modulate or that code for those receptors, so how those receptors are structured and how those receptors function, the genes responsible for them, and any alterations in those genes that one carries definitely determines how they respond to marijuana. So, for example, individuals who have a mutation in a specific gene seem to be more vulnerable to the rewarding effects. Their brains seem to respond more to marijuana.
Why do we have cannabinoid receptors? It's not simply we didn't evolve to use marijuana, right? Do our bodies produce cannabinoids?
Exactly. We have natural cannabinoids called anandamide, and they are there for a reason, to regulate all these varied processes because they are all over the brain. They modulate a lot of activities, one of them being reward and motivation, but in addition, psychomotor processes, appetite regulation, pain, and so on.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Nicholas in Dallas. Hi, Nicholas.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thank you.
So I caught only just briefly the last little bit of the show when the guest was speaking about what causes the desire for cannabis. And as a 24-year smoker who is currently on a rolling six-week hiatus at the moment, as I'm looking for a new job, I can say that being around it, because a lot of my friends still smoke, looking at it, holding it, touching it, none of those things create the desire within me as the olfactory sense does. Being able to smell, not necessarily even just someone who is smoking, but the fresh plant itself, especially after it has been run through a grinder, so you have a really nice bouquet and aromatic blend and the oils have really been released into the air. That smell really is what triggers my craving to say, boy, ooh, I wish I was smoking that with you, where looking at a bong or rolling paper or any other sensory input, even tactile, I feel is negligible compared to the ability to smell it. I would encourage her to find a way to maybe get some research in a state where she could authentically reproduce that smell, because I think she would find a striking result. I don't believe I'm the only person who would respond favorably to the smell.
Thoughts, Francesca?
Yes, I think that's a valid point. I'm going to joke for a second, but we actually have marijuana incense to try to emulate some of that. But you're right. I have to move to a different state to be able to conduct that study. But you know what's interesting, and you might find this interesting as well, is that subjectively, so when we ask individuals whether they actually feel craving or have the urge when we show them the paraphernalia. Well, some of them say yes. I have to say that that it's very moderate subjectively. Their self-reported or their conscious level of urge in response to tactile or visual stimulation. But what's interesting is how it seems to contradict how the brain responds. The brain areas where we expect to see craving and an urge seem to still respond to visual and tactile modalities. But I do think that certainly if we could get greater subjective response in terms of craving, we would probably also get similarly increased brain response.
Robert, is there evidence that in states that have allowed for some marijuana use that the stigma around marijuana use changes?
You know, that's something that I couldn't answer. I would think, though, that in the states that have legalized, those changes in legislation are resulting from societal changes. So people are voting in lawmakers to make these changes. So I think that there are probably different stigma associated with use and the things surrounding use in those states that have legalization for whatever reason, as opposed to those that don't. I think that's just a kind of part of doing business.
Just as individuals, have you formed an understanding of why the stigma is so different for marijuana than it is for alcohol? You can have perfectly respectable, you can have senators talking about having too much to drink last night who would never admit to having smoked a joint.
I'm not sure I can directly answer that question, but I guess all I could say is certainly culture and years and years of perception certainly is contributes to the difference. I guess thinking about how we've changed our perception of cigarettes, for instance, just in the last couple of years, is a way to try to understand that and how how tobacco companies have definitely been put in a different perspective from years ago. Give some insight as to how stigma changes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here that asks if there have been studies of, or if the studies include veterans who are self-medicating for things like PTSD or traumatic brain injury. Do you have individuals like that in your study, or would that be sort of a separate thing that, that someone would look at?
Yes, it's not that it's not one that I'm actively engaged in, but I know that there are high co-occurrences in those clinical disorders. So I can't say directly, but it's certainly one that's actively being studied.
Robert, do we know anything about how access to marijuana changes? I mean, from the calls that we've had, it appears that no one in the state of Texas who wants marijuana has problems accessing it. There are states that have made it a requirement, if you want to do this legally, to go through dispensaries. Is it harder to get marijuana through a dispensary than it is to find someone on the street to sell it to you?
That's a question I couldn't answer either, but I think it's safe to bet that marijuana is widely available throughout the nation and across the globe. I think that once legalization occurs, the means by which the product ends up in the hands of those that wish to use it is completely different, and that's the end of it. It's simply either going to be regulated and controlled like it is in some states, or it's going to be transactions are going to be processed on the black market.
Are most medical marijuana dispensaries, I have not walked into one of these, but my understanding is that they still have, you know, funky names for each kind of marijuana. I mean, do you imagine that if this is something that is spread throughout larger areas of the country, it will be more sort of standardized and branded and less jokey? Do you know what I'm saying in terms of how the product is presented?
From what I've read about how Colorado handles the products and how they're presented in the stores, there's quite a bit of regulation that goes along with those shops. It's not something where you can walk into a convenience store and buy a alcohol or cigarettes. It's much more regulated. I do know that there are the funky names and so forth, but there is also a strong level of oversight from the government in terms of how strong the chemicals are in the drug and so forth, and variety of different outlets that it is provided through, whether it's the general form they smoke or in some food product.
Francesco, what's next for you in terms of research? Once you have looked into the triggers for cravings, what do you want to investigate?
The long-term effects. So the next study that I'm very excited about is to really follow individuals over their use, their years of use, to see if there are actually any long-term effects, to see if these effects linger over the initial use.
Francesca Philby is Associate Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Texas at Dallas. Robert Morris is Associate Professor of Criminology at UTD. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.